Do you accept this?
Bueno, lo que pasa es que nos estamos fortaleciendo cada día más.
Well, the thing is that we are getting stronger every day. They might be shutting the doors to us in these elections, but our aim is not just elections. Our struggle is getting stronger. We have showed that we have followed all the legal procedures. We are peace-loving peoples, and we respect the laws and procedures for participation. But despite that, they prohibit our participation. But we get stronger and stronger because our aim is not just to participate in elections. We want to go beyond that, proposing a project for the nation with structural changes, fighting corruption. Corruption is there because there are structural problems. It's a sign of the structural problems. And so we say, we have identified the illness, but we have the medicine, which is our proposal. And we're going to be strengthening our proposal, showing that we too know how to denounce the situation internationally, and that we are able to follow the procedures. This is the path that we're following now.
Guatemalan presidential candidate Thelma Cabrera and her running mate, Jordán Rodas, they have been banned from running for president in Guatemala's June election. Special thanks to Maria Teresena, Charina Nadura, Sam Malkoff, Mike Burke, Robbie Karen, and Charlie Roberts. Oh, and congratulations to my beloved niece, Anna, and Scott on the birth of their son, Hugo Solomon. Welcome to the world, Hugo, and congratulations to his big brother, Miles. From his Kvelentia.
You're listening to All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 2, KBOO's special programming campaign. Check out all the special programs we're bringing you in February and March at kboo.fm/thrills. Help us reach our goal of $17,000 by March 25th. You can go to kboo.fm/give or text us. Type in KBOO to the number 44321. For the thrill of it all, keep listening.
KBOO is hiring a full-time web coordinator. The web coordinator maintains the front end of KBOO's website, promotes episodes, does copy editing, and helps train staff and volunteers on various website features. For the full job description and instructions for applying, please go to our website at kboo.fm/webhire23. Applications are due at midnight on Thursday, March 9th. KBOO is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer.
This is KBOO Portland.
Welcome to...
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Proud Boy Tusitala Tiny Tosi could face 5 years of jail time for assault and riot charges.
Oregon's mask mandate in healthcare settings will end April 3rd.
And Portlanders voiced their concerns about gunshot detection technology.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 3rd, 2023. I'm Ashley Mackey.
And I'm Reed Johnson. The Proud Boy brawler, who was a mainstay in violent clashes with anti-fascists, has been found guilty on 10 counts related to that violence. Tusitala Tiny Tosi was found guilty on 4 assault charges, 2 counts of riot, 2 charges of first-degree criminal mischief, and 2 counts of unlawful use of a weapon. These charges stem back to a so-called Patriot rally in August of 2021. Tosi helped organize the rally and spoke from the top of a truck bed calling for violence against left-wing protesters at the event. The rally turned violent, with people shooting paintballs and bear mace, and someone threw mortar fireworks near a gas station. According to the affidavit, Tosi was one of those leading the violence. It's not the first time he has faced criminal charges for similar behavior. In 2017, he punched a counter-protester in the face unprovoked and got probation for a harassment charge. In 2018, he was charged with assault, but fled to American Samoa. Tosi could face up to 5 years in state prison for his charges. A sentencing hearing is scheduled for March 24th.
Oregon's COVID-19 mask mandate for healthcare settings will end on April 3rd. That's according to today's announcement by the Oregon Health Authority. The end of the mandate coincides with the end of Washington's mask mandate for healthcare settings. Oregon's mandate has been in effect since August of 2021 and covers all healthcare settings, ranging from hospitals and doctors' clinics to school nurses' offices. Oregon State Epidemiologist Dean Seidlinger says the decision to end the mandate was based on data showing recent decreases in the number of COVID-19, RSV, and influenza cases. These three respiratory illnesses caused a surge in hospitalizations last fall. Seidlinger noted the month between the announcement and the end of the mandate will give healthcare providers time to adjust and establish new health and safety policies. These may include in-house mask requirements. Some raise concerns that this could lead to confrontation with patients refusing clinics' mask policies. Seidlinger responded, saying, "We would ask our healthcare partners to handle that in the same way that they do now, offer them a mask and educate them about the need to wear a mask." The OHA says it's a good time for at-risk individuals to make healthcare appointments and take protective measures. It continues to urge anyone feeling sick to wear a mask to minimize others' exposure.
Mayor Ted Wheeler's proposed plan to use gunshot detection technology in policing faces increased public opposition. Dozens of Portlanders voiced their concern about the city's proposed pilot program at a nearly three-hour-long town hall on Wednesday, hosted by the Portland Committee on Community Engaged Policing. While many stated a need to address gun violence, no one spoke in favor of the technology, which uses artificial intelligence to detect possible gunshots and alert police. Amanda Lamb with the Oregon Justice Resource Center said, quote, "Portland does need long-term community-centered approaches to addressing our gun violence problem, but what we don't need is a police surveillance tool that can be used to further victimize the very communities that we're trying to help." The city is currently reviewing bids by four companies who offer gunshot detection technology. One of these companies is under investigation by the city auditor for lobbying violations. Recent studies have poked holes in the claims of the technology's effectiveness. Cities and jurisdictions using one of these, ShotSpotter, have not seen a decrease in gun violence, but rather an increase in police incidents. Wheeler's office couldn't answer whether the city would halt the project in response to this input.
Workers at Portland's Living Room Theaters voted to form a new independent union this week called the United Cinema Workers. Their union drive started in December when workers were discussing an employee who was fired and a manager told them not to talk about it. Staff has described this as an unfair labor practice and organized a sit-in and a picket in early January in protest. Server and new union president Audra Sweetland told the Portland Mercury, quote, "We showed unrest about a co-worker being fired for reasons that we felt were illegal, unfair, and unwarranted, and without warning. So we tried to bring those concerns to work, and we were told to stop speaking about it at work and outside of work," end quote. That organizing set off the unionizing drive. Workers voted 6-4 on Wednesday to unionize, and Living Room Theaters decided to voluntarily recognize them. That stands in sharp contrast to other corporations, local and national, that have launched union-busting campaigns. This includes Starbucks, New Seasons, Voodoo Donut, and Burgerville. Despite the voluntary recognition, though, workers say the Living Room Theater's CEO did call a mandatory meeting before the election to discuss his opinions on unions. The new union says they plan to file an unfair labor practice complaint about this issue.
The Oregon Senate passed a measure preventing school districts from limiting educational time for students with disabilities without the parents' consent. Both state and federal law guarantee people the right to access a public education with a licensed instructor for all Oregon students. But some students with disabilities were removed from school or were only offered abbreviated days or online instruction. Parents complained their children with disabilities were not getting proper instruction time. There are at least 1,000 documented cases where students were blocked from obtaining the education they were guaranteed under law. Senate Bill 819 passed with bipartisan support. The bill would give the teachers Standards and Practices Commission the ability to investigate and sanction school districts that violate the law. The Oregon Department of Education could also declare that a district is out of compliance and withhold state funding. Now, a parent or guardian's signature is required before a school can shorten their child's school day. Testimony in favor of the measure cited how the pandemic and staffing shortages contributed to the problem. Senate Republican leader Tim Knopp supported the measure. Knopp said, quote, "Our Constitution of Oregon, the Constitution of the United States of America, says we are all equal under the law. It doesn't say we are all equal under the law except disabled children. There are no exceptions," end quote.
U.S. and Russian foreign affairs officials got the chance to talk at the G20 summit, and healthcare executives testify about community health centers. With more on the story, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The new START Treaty, which places verifiable limits on the nuclear arsenals of the United States and the Russian Federation. Mutual compliance is in the interest of both our countries.
During the G20 summit in India, Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Blinken urged Russia to call off its invasion of Ukraine and continue abiding by the START Treaty. While no agreement at the summit was reached on addressing the war in Ukraine, some feel Blinken's and Lavrov's first meeting since the crisis in Ukraine began showed communication is open between Washington and Moscow, if only for the moment. Meanwhile, the Conservative Political Action Conference began in Maryland on Thursday, marked by mostly disparaging remarks and conversations about Democrats, liberals, and the Biden administration. While some opined about the White House's response to such crises as a Chinese spy balloon floating across the country, fentanyl overdoses in the U.S., and illegal aliens entering from the southern border, others spoke of how to make America great again. Louisiana Senator John Kennedy said that under Republican leadership, the nation thrived.
In 4 years, we cut taxes, increased wages, delivered 3.5% unemployment, created 8 million new jobs, deregulated the economy, controlled inflation, protected life.
Keynote speakers of the first day were Alabama Senator Tommy Tuberville and former Acting Attorney General Matt Whitaker, who discussed wokeness in schools. Today, Republican presidential candidate Nikki Haley is expected to deliver remarks. The conference will culminate Saturday with a speech by former President Donald Trump. Community healthcare executives from across the country testified before the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee. They spoke on a range of issues from Medicare reimbursements to mental health and staffing shortages. Carolina Health Center's president and CEO Sue Veer described a new way her organization has been able to lure people to work in the community healthcare system.
One of the things that we've recently done is begun to provide stipends, living stipends in second year residency, with a commitment for a 4 year service agreement. Yep. So in addition to loan repayment, that helps us.
Now that the Supreme Court has heard oral arguments in two cases about President Joe Biden's student loan forgiveness program, its advocates are concerned the program might not endure. Wisdom Cole with the NAACP notes there needs to be a reevaluation of how people think about student loan debt.
We need to recognize and reshift our thinking about how we're thinking about student debt, thinking about this as an opportunity to right the wrongs of the past, an opportunity to reduce the racial wealth gap.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
In last fall's election, Portland and Multnomah County voters passed new laws to allow ranked choice elections. Benton County and Corvallis used ranked choice voting in the 2022 election. There's also a bill in the Oregon legislature this session to bring ranked choice voting to state elections, too. But not all states are as enthusiastic about the voting innovation. Legislation in Montana would prohibit ranked choice voting in elections. Supporters say the election method has benefits, including eliminating the need for two elections. Eric Tagadoff has more.
Montana lawmakers are considering banning a way of running elections known as ranked choice voting. Under this election system, people rank their top choices in order of preference. And as candidates no longer become viable based on the number of votes, voters' next option is counted. Will Mantell with Fair Votes says ranked choice voting has benefits, such as for local nonpartisan elections. He says these elections often are done in two rounds, with the two highest vote getters from round one running off in round two. Mantell notes the first round of elections usually has low turnout, forcing cities or counties to pay for two elections.
With ranked choice voting, you can do that all in one election with a quote-unquote instant runoff that identifies a majority winner in a crowded field.
Opponents of ranked choice voting say they make elections less transparent and can lead to ballot exhaustion, which occurs when all of the candidates marked on the ballot are no longer in the contest. Ranked choice voting is used in local elections across the country and statewide in Alaska and Maine. Mantell says ranked choice voting is still a novel concept in Montana.
It's important to note that there are no Montana cities that are actually using ranked choice voting at this point. So I'm not sure why the state would want to preemptively take this option away from cities if it's something that they want to try.
A similar measure has been introduced in the Idaho legislature. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For Big Sky Connection, I'm Eric Taganoff.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be rainy with an overnight low of 35 degrees. That rain continues into tomorrow with a daytime high of 44. Today in history, in 1875, the first ever organized game of indoor ice hockey is played in Montreal, Quebec, Canada. The quote of the day is from English writer D.H. Lawrence, who said, quote, "I never saw a wild thing sorry for itself. A small bird will drop frozen dead from a bough without ever having felt sorry for itself."
The pattern of missing and murdered Indigenous people in Arizona persists, and researchers want to know why and what can be done to prevent it. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Researchers at Arizona State University are tackling the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous people in the state. They're trying to figure out why it's happening and what can be done to stop it. Alex Gonzalez reports.
Professor Kate Fox directs ASU's Research on Violent Victimization Lab. She says the data speaks for itself. The killing of Indigenous females has been increasing over the past 40 years. Through data obtained through grassroots organizations and law enforcement agencies, Fox and her team, along with the state, have determined 160 Indigenous females were known to police to be murdered between 1976 and 2018 in Arizona. She says that number is expected to be much higher as many cases go unreported. Fox says only recently has the conversation shifted to look at all Indigenous people.
There is a growing recognition across the nation and across the globe that this is not something that only impacts Indigenous women and girls. It does impact all Indigenous peoples.
In 2019, Arizona passed a law that established a study committee to investigate how serious of a problem this was in Arizona. Fox says there's still a lot of work to be done and hopes Arizona, as well as other states, continue to investigate. Fox says systemic factors rooted in racial injustice, violence, and colonization are responsible for the crisis. Fox says the report produced by the committee found the danger heavily affected Indigenous females from 20 to 40 years old. Around 30% of the cases are committed by unknown offenders, with 28% of cases involving an intimate partner. Fox says not only is the work her primarily Indigenous team producing critically important, it's being given back to Indigenous communities to know and use. She says it's possible to create safe and healthy communities.
It's just going to take a lot of collaboration across Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples and organizations. It's going to take the westernized way of thinking, transitioning and acknowledging and working within Indigenous worldview.
Fox encourages people to get educated on the true history and treatment of Indigenous people. I'm Alex Gonzalez.
The Aleutic Museum in Kodiak, Alaska has honored Chris Woolley as its Volunteer of the Year. He's being recognized for his research about children who were sent to boarding schools in the lower 48. KMXT's Brian Venois reports.
The Aleutic Museum's Volunteer of the Year award recognizes folks who spend time working on projects with the museum, and this year's award went to Kodiak resident Chris Woolley for his work on the Carlisle Repatriation Project. He says while he's grateful for the award, he was just one part of the research team.
Well, it was mixed emotions. I was really happy, but I want to share it with the others in the group that are doing just as much work as I am.
The research project is aimed at contacting descendants of indigenous children taken from Aleutic lands to a boarding school in Pennsylvania and repatriating their remains. Part of his work with the project included contacting the family of Anastasia Ashawick, whose remains were brought back to the village of Old Harbor for reburial in her family's plot last year. His team is still searching for the descendants of Periscovia Friendoff, another Native girl taken from nearby Woody Island. She was taken to the outing program, where children were sent to be acculturated to Western lifestyles.
We're trying to kind of track down any reference to Periscovia, who had spent 4 years in that outing program with families in Pennsylvania. Not clear if there's any relatives. It doesn't sound like there are, but her story is a bit of an enigma.
Willie says it's been more difficult to find records of Periscovia than it was for Anastasia. I'm Brian Venois.
The National Congress of American Indians has acquired rights to the Crying Indian, the Keep America Beautiful anti-pollution campaign of the 1970s. Ownership of the public service announcement has been transferred to NCAI by the nonprofit Keep America Beautiful, which decided to officially retire it. The ad featured stereotypical imagery of Native people and misappropriated Native culture. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Across the country, clean air advocacy groups want the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to strengthen standards for soot pollution. The EPA recently proposed tightening its national air quality standards for soot pollution, which haven't been updated since 2012. Groups say soot is dangerous and the agency needs to do more to protect public health. Danielle Smith has more on the story in Arkansas.
The EPA is proposing tougher air quality standards for soot pollution, and an Arkansas clean air advocacy group says it's a step in the right direction. Soot is fine particulate matter from power plants, vehicles, and refineries, and the EPA wants to revise its national ambient air quality standards for soot. Glenn Hooks with the group Audubon Delta says the EPA proposal would reduce the maximum allowable amount of this type of pollution from 12 micrograms per cubic meter of air to 9 or 10. He says Arkansas has 5 older coal-burning power plants, and controlling their pollution output would improve public health outcomes and save lives.
Communities that are near those power plants, those communities tend to have higher levels of asthma. They have higher levels of premature death. Particulate matter is the kind of thing that gets in your lungs and really causes health problems. And so solving that problem either by retiring coal-burning power plants in favor of cleaner energy solutions or cleaning up the power plants that we do have, it should be a priority for healthy communities.
The EPA says the plan reflects the latest health data and scientific evidence, but it is accepting feedback based on other suggestions as well. The agency held public hearings in February and is taking public comments until March 28th. Patrick Drupp, director of climate policy for the Sierra Club, says everyone has the right to breathe clean air, but that's being denied to a lot of people around the country. He notes the agency's own scientific advisory committee has recommended tougher standards.
The EPA could save up to 20,000 lives per year based on their own science and their own analysis. Adopting a more stringent standard, going from the low end of what they proposed of 9 to what we're asking for of no higher than 8, could save an additional 4,000 lives.
He adds 63 million Americans live in areas with unhealthy spikes of soot pollution, and 20 million live with dangerous levels year-round. I'm Danielle Smith, Arkansas News Service.
New legislation could officially ban discharging radioactive waste into New York's waterways. It stems from a controversy surrounding Holtec International's plan to dump treated but still radioactive waste from the Indian Point facility into the Hudson River. Edwin J. Vieira has more.
New York lawmakers have introduced a bill to ban radioactive waste from being discharged from the Indian Point Energy Center. This comes as the facility's owner, Holtec International, is considering dumping treated, but still radioactive, waste into the Hudson River. The river has a history of pollutants being dumped into it, and some 200 river miles are classified as a Superfund site by the EPA. During a forum about the implications of Holtec's actions, physicist Dr. Helen Caldicott describes some of what could end up in the Hudson, such as tritium.
You can't remove tritium from water because tritium becomes part of the water, H3O instead of H2O. Tritium gets out into the atmosphere from nuclear power plants, and if you're immersed in a cloud of fog near a nuclear power plant, the tritium in the fog can actually enter the skin.
The bill has been introduced by State Senator Peter Harkin. It would fine violators $25,000 a day if caught dumping radiological agents into New York State waters. Second violation fines would increase to $50,000 a day. The bill is under review in the State Senate Environmental Conservation Committee. Up to this point, Holtec International has worked closely with state agencies to ensure a safe process based partly on the joint proposal to decommission Indian Point. Dr. Diane Turco with Cape Downwinders says this is a moment when elected officials need to stand up for their constituents.
Let's see, can our laws really protect the people? And can our legislators and our elected officials do the best for the people? This is a real big test.
Earlier this month, at a meeting of the Indian Point Closure Task Force and Decommissioning Oversight Board, residents spoke against dumping the waste and recommended other methods. One option is leaving the waste in tanks on site so radioactive agents are safer to remove. Others include transferring it to out-of-state sites and possibly allowing the wastewater to evaporate. I'm Edwin J. Vieira, New York News Connection.
The U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has refused to stop the development of the Thacker Pass lithium mine in northern Nevada while a case filed by conservation groups is reviewed. The groups warn letting the project go forward will result in permanent damage to the area and set a dangerous precedent for future projects. Alex Gonzalez has the details.
The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has refused to stop developers of the Thacker Pass lithium mine in northern Nevada while an appeal by conservation groups is being considered. The groups say they're disappointed with the decision, as they hoped filing an emergency motion with the court would stop the development, at least until their appeal could be heard. But the court gave mine developers the green light to proceed. John Hatter with the Great Basin Resource Watch predicts the decision will bring serious and unfortunate impacts to the area.
That means that there's damage that will be done to the site before the case can be heard on its merits later this year. And a lot of that damage is irreversible, particularly to cultural sites. Once they're damaged, you can't really go back.
Groups like Hatter say the project has been fast-tracked in defiance of environmental law, all in the name of clean energy, as lithium is a component of electrical vehicles. The president and CEO of Lithium America says the company is excited about the prospect of generating economic growth in northern Nevada and playing a major role in the domestic lithium supply chain. Hatter says part of the conservation group's argument is that the Bureau of Land Management violated the Federal Land Policy and Management Act, meaning the environmental impact statement for the project is tainted. He says damage to the site could have been avoided had the analysis been done correctly in the first place. Hatter predicts the project will be a major blow to a critical sage-grouse population and could also set a dangerous tone for future mining projects.
Could set a precedent for a sloppier and faster permitting of faster analysis and that misses key aspects in protecting the environment and communities, and that is a dangerous pathway.
Hatter says as the country moves forward with its energy transitions, it's important that standards are not relaxed in terms of how projects are analyzed and evaluated. For Nevada News Service, I'm Alex Gonzalez.
Mandatory disclosures would help renters choose a more efficient home, a recent experiment found. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. A well-insulated home with efficient appliances can feel more comfortable and save residents money on their utility bills. Reuven Sussman is with the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy.
Energy efficiency is particularly important for renters because renters tend to have lower incomes than owners.
He says despite the benefits, most rental listings do not include information about efficiency. So Sussman's team created a mock rental listings website to determine if providing this information prompted people to choose more efficient homes.
And we actually saw that the behavior did change.
But only if the information was provided in context. His team found that renters needed to know how efficient a house or apartment is compared to others in the area. For example, by seeing how the listing ranks on a scale of 1 to 10. And efficiency data had to be provided on all listings. So he says to be effective, efficiency labeling must be required.
If you're going to start a labeling policy, maybe start with a voluntary one, but don't let that be the ultimate goal. Eventually, we'd like to see people moving towards mandatory policies where all buildings are labeled, and that's definitely going to help us see some behavior change.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 3rd, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Reed Johnson. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, Danielle Smith, Alex Gonzalez, Eric Tegedoff, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ashley Mackey.
And I'm Reed Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin.